In the first two books, I attempt to understand why the Olympics seem to hold almost universal appeal, and they manage to avoid the kind of public scrutiny and media and academic scrutiny that most multinational counterparts are subjected to. And I use Chomsky and Herman's propaganda model and talk about corporate elites manufacturing consent with persuasive messages obscuring the profit motive. And with the Olympics, we have rhetoric about peace building, intercultural understanding, celebration of sporting excellence. And Olympic critics don't have access, obviously, to a public relations budget that resembles anything like the Olympic budget. You saw that in Vancouver with the plebiscite, where the amount of money that the yes side had to plaster the city with vote yes messages was huge compared to the shoestring amount of money that the no side had to try to get word out. And I can't remember, maybe someone here can tell me, it was something like it cost the yes side $9 to generate a yes vote and it cost the no side 60 cents or something. Does that sound right?
That's more like it.
Yeah. Yeah. So there was no resounding yes support for this. Because journalists are sometimes, in the last few days, have been asking me, why do I think that there's not huge excitement among residents of Whistler and Vancouver, or more specifically Vancouver. But there was no resounding groundswell of support in the beginning. So as things unfold, there's more and more reason not to be excited on that front. So rather than continue with looking at this kind of propaganda machinery, I wanted to look at a more fundamental question, and that was the socialization of children and youth to think about sport in general and the Olympics in particular in largely uncritical ways. And so I look at the athletes as role models rhetoric, particularly celebrity athletes as role models, and an enterprise that is probably not very well known amongst the vast majority of us, and that's Olympic education in the schools. And I started with the idea of role models because that's a favourite one. There's Olympic athletes serving as role models, curriculum materials presenting Olympic facts, figures and ideologies in the guise of Olympic education. And the role model concept is very popular in every sector. As drawing some parallels, it's useful for leaders in business or politics who are predominantly white and male to point to a female or a minority role model, regardless of their statistically small numbers, as evidence of a meritorious system. See, she made it to the top of that big corporation, so anyone can. And psychologists have argued that role models are important because there's an emotional as well as a cognitive, there is emotional as well as cognitive significance to shared membership in a gender group or some other subgroup. So girls benefit from seeing an alternative, stronger, healthier vision of themselves, their bodies, an athletic woman, and that's better than image offered by an anorexic fashion model or movie star. On the other hand, this is very individualistic. There may be individual psychological benefits, but if the goal is systemic change, social change, not just attitudinal change, then there are some shortcomings with this individualistic role model approach. And it specifically ignores the systemic barriers that are posed by gender and racial discrimination, poverty, disability, geography, and many, many other social variables. And these are barriers to children and adolescents' access to sport and recreation. But the notion persists that a successful athlete is a positive example not just of how to be a successful athlete, but how to be a successful human being. And we only have to look at the front pages of the newspaper or the sport pages to see that celebrity athletes have feet of clay very frequently. As somebody, a sport philosopher who I quoted in the book, said, the athlete you have in front of your class on Friday may show up on the front page of Saturday's paper getting carted off in handcuffs because he's beaten up his girlfriend. More probable in professional sport, but being an athlete of any kind doesn't make you immune to the kind of human failings that characterize human beings. They're not perfect, but as recently as 1996, I'm quoting a report from the Sport Matters Group. It recommended that Canada should, quote, position athletes as true Canadian role models who embody excellence both in sport and in life. And somehow these high-performance athletes are more worthy than non-athletes, which is probably everyone in the room who isn't an Olympic athlete, to fulfill the task of inspiring youth, but I'm not sure how their excellence as human beings could be measured. And that is, the problem is blurring sport and life, saying that they embody excellence in sport and in life. Some do, some don't. They exemplify sporting achievement, but their function as moral exemplars can't be taken for granted. And I would argue that a good moral example is a well-rounded person, and a non-Olympic athlete is likely to be more well-rounded than an Olympic athlete by definition, because to be an Olympic athlete, there has to be single-minded pursuit of sporting excellence, often to the detriment of normal social development and growth and other, perhaps even intellectual, cognitive academic growth. And there's little evidence that a remote celebrity figure like an athlete or an actor or a rapper or whoever has any lasting impact on kids and youth. But people involved on an everyday basis in young people's socialization, like parents, siblings, teachers, coaches, neighbors, religious leaders, community leaders, are a more significant influence in shaping lives, and I would argue more appropriate role models than Olympic athletes. So there's plenty of evidence of the fallen heroes phenomenon among athletes, celebrity and Olympic and professional and so on. There's daily examples of athletes behaving badly. And they're not necessarily completely to blame for the responsibilities that are loaded on them. They didn't necessarily take on the job of being a role model for kids. Many of them are young themselves and they lack life experience outside of sport. And there are these formal role model programs organized by Olympic committees. Canadian Olympic Committee has one. They rarely provide the pedagogical training that a person would need to communicate with children. So they're sent into an auditorium, usually a large group of kids. They show a video, the athlete shows a video of themselves winning a medal. They give an inspirational talk. They say you can be anything you want to be, you just need an Olympic dream, work hard and you'll succeed. Those are three lies. You cannot be anything you want to be, you don't just need an Olympic dream. And working hard is good, but does not guarantee success, particularly in the Olympic arena. Just as an aside, in the US, the NCAA handbooks give recruits or hopefuls, NCAA hopefuls coming out of high school or college, the statistics on the probability that you will become an NBA star, for example, or an NFL star, and it's something like 0.01% or something. We should be telling that to kids in classrooms, that your chance of being an Olympic athlete is 0.0%. But instead, there's these myths being promulgated and reinforced through Olympic education and through the initiatives of the Canadian Olympic Committee or any national Olympic committee. the Toronto Star had a free booklet, and the fact that the corporations or the newspapers produce free curriculum materials, the Royal Bank is the big one for the current games, so teachers are overworked, underpaid, stressed. Having a package, having a visiting athlete has quite an appeal. You can get the kids to sit and listen and colour in the whatever and do the curriculum, the worksheets and so on, and it's all laid out for you. There's Olympic literacy, there's Olympic numeracy, there's social studies, there's history, you know, all with a theme, with an Olympic theme. So this Toronto Star thing had was really promoting the Toronto Bid slogan, Expect the World. It talked about using children's videotape testimonials in a youth day to promote the bid. I consider that the exploiting of children's free labour, and that's what happened in Sydney. They had, and I documented some of those examples in the Best Olympics Ever, kids are routinely exploited to sort of play cutesy roles in when the IOC inspection team comes, or ethnic minority kids in their national clothing, or Indigenous children and adults singing and dancing. That kind of exploitation is typical of bids, and opening and closing ceremonies for that matter. So there are some other Canadian examples that I do a content analysis of some of the curriculum materials, and I find the same trends, some in Australia, some in New Zealand, London, England, presenting the Olympics as an unqualified good thing, no critique. If there's any talk of protest, protesters are called a problem. There's no, just under the rubric of media literacy in elementary schools, a good teacher could use the Olympics as a case study and show kids in an age-appropriate way how to deconstruct Olympic messages, just as they deconstruct messages from Coke or Pepsi or McDonald's. But the Olympics don't seem to be, they seem to be immune to that kind of thing. So this Vancouver Whistler product from the Royal Bank of Canada and the Canadian Olympic School Program, particular one that I printed out, you get easy access to this if you go onto the Canadian Olympic School Program website and register as a parent or a teacher or an interested person. I just registered as a educator because I am, and you can print out this stuff. This one's called Money Management: Save, Share, Spend. And the front page says, to be an Olympian requires hours of hard work and discipline. Learn from some of Canada's top Olympians how they manage their money so they can chase their dreams. And Clara Hughes is on the cover, which is interesting because she is somebody who, one of the few, I think there were a couple of athletes who donated a very generous amount, $10,000 in her case, to the Right to Play, which has its own problems, which I delve into in my book, but nevertheless a very well-intentioned gift, and yet she's in this book that is a model of capitalist thinking. Kids are given exercises, you know, if you have this much money and you put it in the bank, you know, and you get interest, such as it is, then 2 years from now you'll be able to afford whatever the thing was that you were dreaming about. Now, unbeknownst to me, but maybe I'm not fully informed, the Canadian Olympic Foundation is presented almost as if it's a charity. It would surprise me if it has charitable status, but I'm willing to be corrected. So there's a whole project on called Sharing Money, a class project to raise money for the Canadian Olympic Foundation. Every Olympic athlete dreams of winning a medal, but earning a medal can be expensive. The Canadian Olympic Foundation supports our athletes by providing the money they needed for coaching, travel and equipment. I kind of thought the Canadian Olympic Committee and national and provincial sports governing bodies did that, but I do know, obviously, there are athletes in the less funded and less popular sports that are living on craft dinners because they're not on the national hockey team or whatever. So here's this thing about buying pizza and then selling it as a profit and so on. And that's the exercise in Olympic numeracy, so you can see why I have a problem. So finally, no stone unturned, since half of the book is an analysis of education involving children and youth, I don't hesitate, as you know from the previous books, to implicate the university, many universities in Australia and Canada in particular, the ones I'm familiar with, as being collaborators in the Olympic industry. The material benefits and cultural capital gained by academics who are generally supportive of the Olympics contribute to the chilly climate that I've experienced and many of my critical sport colleagues have experienced. There is a threat to academic freedom posed by the corporatisation of universities, which is another whole big issue. But it seems I'm puzzled and disturbed when I see that sports scholars who are critical of virtually every other aspect of sport hold back when it comes to the Olympics, and I wonder if their unofficial membership in the so-called Olympic family, because they are in centres for Olympic studies that are growing up around Western countries and Western countries. And the goosebumps effect of rubbing shoulders with Olympic athletes and sporting celebrities, and this all leads them to refrain from seeing the Olympics as critically as one would hope an academic would do, given that there is, in theory, academic freedom in the universities. An American sports sociologist has suggested that has identified this puzzle that there are academics who have been very effective in other realms as public intellectuals, bringing policy change into effect, and yet the debates about the Olympics, the debates about the stadium fiascos in the US, and the what he calls the corporate welfare system that supports professional sport in the United States, the critics haven't, to the extent that they have been critical, haven't had very much tangible impact on public policy. And he wonders whether it's the strength of the emotionalism of sport, the lack of power of academics within urban politics, or other factors that lead to such little success. And I would think it's the emotionalism, and I can't imagine parallels in other scholarly fields where there are celebrity figures. Do scholars in musicology or popular culture or environmental studies avoid critiquing the work of Luciano Pavarotti or Elton John or David Suzuki because they don't want to destroy the, quote, magic, or because they are moved by, quote, the light in children's eyes? But I hear that kind of rhetoric in some Olympic sport studies circles. So, just as a concrete example of the universities embracing the Olympics, my book came out. I had a launch in Sydney and a launch in Toronto last July and August, just around the time of the Beijing Olympics. The official magazine of U of T had a Olympic theme and Olympic athlete on the cover and Olympic stories inside. The official publication of the Faculty of Physical Education and Health, of which I am cross-appointed as a retired professor emerita, had Olympic dreams and Olympic stories. No one approached me or did a review of my book for either of those publications. I didn't expect it. That's the way things have been for 10 years. But here we have another publication, The Costco Connection. Now, you wouldn't think they would ask Helen Lansky to write something in a debate about the Olympics, would you? Well, they did. So they succeeded where U of T failed. Thank you.